Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And today, Adam, we will be talking with Director of the New York Memory Services and Associate Professor at New York University School of Medicine, Dr. Gayatri Devi, about her book, A Calm Brain.
You say that so calmly, Christy.
I know. Just saying it is just like sort of so hopeful for me.
Well, we all can use a little bit more calmness, and we're going to learn from Dr. Devi about how to do that. First, I don't know if it'll make us calmer, but we are going to discuss some research that matters that hopefully will help people make better health decisions.
Yeah, we hope so. We've got something about women making less than men with equal jobs.
And we'll discuss about how that could apply to you, and we've got questions about hospital noises and sleeping, and that's not a good thing.
About taking vitamin D to stop breaks in your bones if you're older.
And side effects of statins as they may relate to fatigue. Well, let's talk about our very first research that matters, Christy, which should matter to you, which is about, though you may not be in the same situation, but women doctors making less money than male doctors.
I know, it's just so wrong. This is a study looking at female doctor researchers and surveying over 800 doctor researchers in the United States, all of whom had previously won a mid-career award from the government. So people at the same stage of their career with similar achievements to find out how much what was their salary, how much did they make, and looking at the differences between men and women.
And all things considered equal, even after adjusting for the number of hours worked, so the males tended to work 63 hours a week and their females tended to work 58 hours per week. But after adjusting for that, the males still made $12,000 more a year than the women for the same type and the same amount of work.
And the question is, of course, why? That seems so wrong that two people doing the exact same job at the same stage of their career would have a difference in pay like that, that is consistently in multiple studies tied to gender. And we really don't know why. Does it have to do with the way women do or do not negotiate for their salaries? Does it have to do...
I think it's conflict, and I think that's exactly... I think hit it on the head, Christy. I think a lot of the people doing the hiring are men. And the women coming in perhaps are feeling there's a power issue and potentially not negotiating, because what you get paid frequently is what you start with. That's the best time to negotiate. And I think this has a potential impact, though, on listeners' health too, because, you know, I think we have so really many good physicians, and the women physicians, I think, really should be getting more salary equal to the men. And hopefully our listeners who have great female physicians can advocate for
that's
that.
That's right. You people out there advocate for us.
Well, I think you know, this hasn't changed in so long, Christy. So I think making listeners aware of that, and when they're in there and they've had good care by their female physicians, write a note to the bosses of the female physicians or the head of those programs and let them know that they want their female physicians to be paid the same if they're not already.
Well, and I think this is true across America in a whole lot of different positions. So whatever career you're in, if you are a working woman, it's worth really looking at this issue. Okay, let's talk about vitamin D.
Yeah, you know, Christy, we've spent a lot of time over the last year or two talking about vitamin D, and I would venture to say a lot of women, even some men, are taking vitamin D and calcium to prevent osteoporosis, particularly for women after kind of the menopause when the risk of osteoporosis is higher. And these are potentially some shattering new recommendations.
Well, I don't find them that shattering. They talk about recommendations suggesting that taking low-dose vitamin D at doses
and calcium,
lower in calcium at lower than 400 international units of vitamin D and at 1,000 milligrams of calcium, do very little, if anything, to prevent fractures.
Well, and this is the kind of the current thinking, though, I think, the standard that a lot of people are just taking. Perhaps a lot of doctors are recommending that they take calcium, 1,000 milligrams, vitamin D, 400 IUs, to prevent osteoporosis. And while there may be a small effect, the United States Preventive Services Task Force is finalizing recommendations to say this is a thumbs down. And I think this is a huge transformation for a lot of women and men and providers. I don't think this is going to go down easily, but I don't know.
Well, I think what's probably going to come out is that the lower doses don't do very much. If you want to make a difference, that you've got to take 800 to 1,200 international units of vitamin D. We also know that there's some research to suggest it prevents falls.
But
so it may not
is
prevent
the calcium,
that
the higher dose of the calcium increases your risk of kidney stones. So I think we're going to we've opened up a can of worms here, and we don't have the answers for it. And perhaps Christy and I have some different views on how this plays out. But I think it's worth talking with your doctor about it next time you come in if you're taking these medicines.
In particular, if you're taking them at low doses. I do think there'll be more coming out about this soon, and Adam and I will be sure to keep our listeners updated.
Speaking of updated, there's a next research that matters, Christy, that has to do with hospital noises and trying to sleep. And I remember, Christy, my father talking about this when he was in the hospital numerous times. And he talked about how awful it was that he would get woken up at 4:30 in the morning to take him to go be weighed. And you know, people coming in all night long.
This is actually it's the most common complaint that people say when they fill out their surveys after a hospitalization. They are woken up too many times in the night, the blood draws, the alarms going off. And I mean, we all could argue that sleep, we all know sleep is important, but we can argue that it's important to healing.
Well, and this was actually some very interesting research that they took 12 healthy people and they took the sounds that people hear in the hospital, the most common sounds like an IV pole going off when it drains, a toilet flushing, people whispering, like in the bed next to you, and they kind of then ratchet up noise in to see where these people get disrupted. And it turns out that even whispering in the room disrupts people in light sleep, and those IV poles wake people up universally. And this is a huge issue, I think, because the way our hospitals are designed and the systems are designed are not to promote people's getting sleep. And we're going to talk about on our show today the need for sleep and a calm brain.
I know. Well, and, you know, alarms and voices were the worst offenders in the study. And, you know, if you're in a private room, doing something like closing a door can be helpful. But a lot of folks, particularly in the newer hospitals and the ones around here, have a lot of times you have more than one people in a room. And so being respectful of the other people in the room is important.
Maybe even having doors that when you close them don't have that clacking sound. That they could be a soft close. I mean, lots of system designs.
Well, I know UNC Hospitals is working on some changes in the hospital rooms that would have things to dull those noises. So people are responding to
this.
When
you go in the hospital, perhaps you should actually have a discussion with your nurses about what things you want to be woken up for and what things you actually don't want to be woken up for, and help us serve you better. Let's talk about our very last research that matters, Christine.
Okay, the last one's about statins. Lots of people are on these drugs to lower cholesterol, prevent stroke, heart attacks, etc. And lots of people are concerned about side effects. And this is a study looking to see if taking simvastatin or Zocor compared with placebo made people feel more tired.
And they were looking at data from 1,000 men and women who had been randomly assigned to take these different drugs versus placebo. And then how many of them actually had some sort of fatigue, whether it's directly related to the drug or not. And what they generally found is that up to 15% of statin users would feel more fatigued before or during exercise, perhaps due to the drugs. And actually, this kind of correlates a little bit with what a lot of patients tell me, Christy. They, you know, they feel worse even if their muscles, you know, that real muscle pain isn't there sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I have a patient who feels different when he rides his bike, when he races, when he's taking the statin versus not. So if this is a problem for you, I would encourage you, don't just stop your medicine. Go talk to your doctor about it. Make a plan.
And be aware that fatigue could be a side effect of any medication use, including statins.
It's
possible.
True. It's possible.
Well, Christy, that concludes our research that matters. We've had a chance to talk about statins and fatigue.
About hospital noises disrupting sleep.
about the real need to for women physicians to make the same as male physicians or more.
And about low-dose vitamin D maybe not making a difference to prevent bone breaks.
Talk to
your
doctors about that and calcium.
Okay. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Gayatri Devi about her book, A Calm Brain. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Director of the New York Memory Services and Associate Professor at New York University School of Medicine, Dr. Gayatri Devi, about her new book, A Calm Brain.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Dr. Devi.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on your show, Christy and Adam.
A Calm Brain. We have been having harried, crazy days, and we're so looking forward to having this conversation about calmness. And wondered if you'd start out by telling us, have you always been a calm person, and is that why you wrote the book, because you've mastered this? Or what is it that led you to write this book?
Well, actually, I've always not been a calm person. I've been kind of a frenzied, harried person. But I knew some very calm people in my life, and it was a goal of mine to become a calm person. And so I finally, I think, achieved it in the last several years, and I wanted to share that with people.
And you are a physician. Tell us a little bit about your medical background and how that has tied in with this.
Well, my background is I'm a neurologist. I'm a practicing neurologist. I also have a background in psychiatry as well. So I see quite a few patients with memory disorders, but I also see patients with migraines and stroke and other illnesses where anxiety plays a big part in the presentation.
You know, I know in your book you talk about some of the inspiration for your real desire to develop this was your grandfather and
yes.
his kind of equanimity in dealing with stresses. Can you describe that kind of input and how it really led you ultimately to want to write a book about this?
So I grew up, you know, in India, and I grew up in a very chaotic family, which was loving and warm, but also prone to the dramatic. And my grandfather, my mother's father, was this wonderfully serene person who just glided through my life. And I was his favorite grandchild. I found him to be extremely calming to be around. I aspired to be like him. And I wanted to grow up and become like him. And he was a very efficient person. I think that was also what struck me, was that in spite of him being so calm, he was also great at getting things done.
This combination of efficient and calm. So it wasn't like he couldn't make large decisions that were complex and sometimes that involved lots of emotion, but he stayed calm in that process.
Exactly. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, we were on the family farm, and I threw some manure into the drinking well from which we all drank from. And he didn't get, I was terrified. No one had water in the house as a result. But he didn't really get angry with me. He scolded me a little. But he then went ahead and got the water together and made sure everyone had safe drinking water. But I just really admired him. And he wasn't like a yogi sitting in a corner not doing very much. I mean, he was a very successful person in life. He ran a very large company, and yet he was able to maintain this equanimity, this efficiency, in the middle of all the frenzy that was life around him.
You talk in your book about some of the ways we're wired, and you talk about our ancestors using that fight or flight phenomenon to protect themselves, and that we're wired to do this. And I wonder how, from your perspective and experience, that this plays out in our modern everyday lives.
So that's a great question, Christy. What happens is, I mean, all of us know about the stress response and how adrenaline kicks in, our heart starts to pound. We start to gear up for some horrible thing that's going to happen. And modern life sets us up for this constantly. We constantly have an annoying email that we can't let go of in our brain. We have so many choices to make. We have deadlines to meet, schedules to keep. And this keeps us in this state of constant frenzy, of constant deadlines, with stress levels always on the high, and very few things that we build into our daily life to relax us. I mean, we may think of a vacation several months down the road, but I think it's more important to schedule mini vacations within the day, times when we can really use the part of our brain that's programmed to relax us.
Well, I know that even in today, the inputs from email and texting and all of the types of sensory inputs that come at you, I see people walking and exercising now, and yet they're doing their texting and email. People, we know about the driving. In your field, this overload, how does it play out in the field of neurology? What do we know? Do you have any examples from any patients?
Sure. I had a patient that I talk about in my book, A Calm Brain, where she came in with migraines. She had an irritable bowel that she was on medication for. She was on medication for her neck and neck pain. She was a very vivacious woman and trying to make it on her own in a business that she just started that she loved. She quit her rat race work in advertising. And she found that her headaches were getting worse, her migraines were getting worse, she couldn't sleep. So it turned out that what she'd really set up for herself is this constant alarm treadmill, where every alarm brought on the next alarm, if you will. And she was unable to really get off that treadmill until we came up with the solution that helped her to go off her meds. She's no longer on medication for migraines. She's no longer on medication for irritable bowels. Her hypertension medication that she was on, she's now on much less of a dose. So this has real impact on life and illness and health.
Well, when we think about that, I think all of us, if you've had moments of calm in the midst of the frenzy, know that that feels better. But what do we know at a population level about those health impacts of chronic stress that you're talking about? What do we know in that linkage?
So we do know that the levels of high blood pressure, of heart disease, of migraines, of headaches, of anxiety and depression are really multiplying very rapidly. And we could say that some of it is related to our poor eating habits and our poor exercise habits, but that often also plays into our stress level. Mm-hmm. So when we are stressed, we tend to eat more. And when we are stressed, we tend to exercise less. So it becomes a vicious cycle. So I think the repercussions, even on a more population-based level, is quite devastating.
We're talking with Dr. Gayatri Devi about her new book, A Calm Brain. And Dr. Devi, you talk about in The Calm Brain, the core brain. To help us understand, what is the core brain and how does this relate to developing a calm brain?
So the core brain, what I call the core brain, is the part of the brain that's crucial for our survival. It's a part of the brain that controls our breathing, our heart rate, our gastric motility, and also controls how we feel about other people, our ability to connect with other human beings, our gut instinct, our core instinctual feeling that we talk about. So that's your core brain. Your modern, more evolved cortical brain, the neocortical brain, particularly the frontal lobes, that's more nuanced. It's more involved in choices and second guessing and scheduling. And in modern life, we tend to favor this newer brain. But our core brain drives how we feel. So we end up having this disconnect between how we schedule ourselves and how we feel. And I think that's where the problem with anxiety and stress comes in.
Well, one of the things I'm really excited to talk about in the next segment is about how we achieve this calmness.
And Chris, teach us Christy a wise one. Christy, I don't want to pay you for this consultation session, but we appreciate it.
Therapy. but also, you know, you talk about it's not about getting rid of stress, but how to manage it. So some of these like really important tips I think will be helpful for us and helpful for our listeners. We do need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Devi, about her book, A Calm Brain. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the director of the New York Memory Services and associate professor at New York University School of Medicine, Dr. Gayatri Devi, about her new book, A Calm Brain. And right before we broke, Dr. Devi, we were talking about how the modern kind of stresses of life impede upon us and beginning to think about, well, how do you develop this calm brain? We all have this picture of what happens when we go out to eat, and I know there's some stories in your book about how you advise people to maybe make some changes. Tell us about how that works in your own life.
Well, it's interesting you ask, Adam. Today I went out for lunch with my daughter, and she has been steeped in this whole calm brain thinking. So she knows that when we're at lunch or when we're at dinner, we should only be doing that. We should turn off our phones. Well, I brought a copy of the paper with me because I hadn't read it in the morning. And just because I had a copy of the paper in my bag with me, I had to constantly make the choice. Whenever there was a lag in the conversation, I wanted to reach in and bring out the paper. And she said to me, "No, Mom, you can't do that. You know, we're supposed to be talking." So I think one of the things that I really advocate is that try to make it easy for yourself so that you don't have to make that choice. You don't have to struggle. What I truly should have done was to have left the paper at home. That way, I didn't have to make that constant decision every minute about whether I should read the paper or spend some time talking with her and having a great meal.
And I have another friend, a very good, dear friend, physician, who has started leaving her phone at night in the other room. It's a bad habit of mine to have it there. It's my alarm clock. It's my email. It's my texting. It's my whatever that is right beside me all night long. But by leaving it in the other room when you go to bed, that seems like that would fall in line with something you would support.
Oh, I absolutely think that's a great idea. I do it myself. I leave my cell phone either turned off or in another room so that I'm not tempted to wake up at night. Let's say because I have to go to the run to the restroom, I don't then check my email just, you know, because I'm up. Because what if I have an email that bothers me or an email that disturbs me? Then I'm going to be sitting there thinking about it when, in fact, I should be sleeping.
And, you know, you describe perfectly a situation on Friday afternoon when I checked an email about 9 or 10 o'clock at night when I really didn't need to. And it was some disturbing news. And here I then had it with me all weekend. It would have been there Monday. And I guess this question is, there are things that we can do, some simple things, some difficult things. Give us some idea of some more maybe simple things, and then we'll talk about the more difficult things. What are some other tips of things that people can do to really have a calmer mind?
First of all, you're absolutely right. Remember that the email will be there on Monday. So I think that's important to remember. Try to turn off the phone for at least an hour a day, your cell phone particularly. It's almost as if we now have to wean ourselves off our phone because we go into withdrawal or we actually become anxious when we're not next to our phone. But in fact, it's an addictive process because we become addicted to checking our phone. So please leave your phone at home if you were to go out for a walk with the dog, say. Try to spend at least one weekend day, or preferably a whole weekend a month, without a schedule. You know, say on Friday, listen, this weekend I'm just going to do things as they occur. I'm not going to check the time.
Why is that?
I'm not going to set the alarm.
Why is that?
Because what that does, all these practices, they activate your parasympathetic nervous system. That's the part of the nervous system. That's the part of your core brain that is in opposition of this to the stress-making mechanism of the adrenaline-based flight or fright response. So that'll just feed into it and make you relaxed, whether you like it or not. I think scheduling alarms, all of these things create within you a sense of freneticness, a sense of time that you don't necessarily need all the time. You need it some of the time to get to work, for example. But on a weekend, why do you need to schedule? You don't really need to. Take a weekend where you have no schedule, no plans, and just see how that unfolds.
Sounds so exciting. The other thing that's exciting to me is you talk in your book about one of my favorite pastimes, sleep. It's something I don't get very much of, but one of my favorite things to do. And I'd love for you to talk a bit about the role and the influence of sleep in stress and calmness.
Sleep is, for me, one of the most underutilized ways to be stress-free. Sleep is cheap. Sleep is something we're all born and experts at. Sleep is when your body consolidates, your brain consolidates memory. It consolidates events from the day. Sleep is when you go to a place of calm, whether you like it or not. And sleep is required and necessary every single day. We need a certain amount of sleep. We probably, most of us, need between 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And few of us get it. But I think what we need to do is to make it a habit to sleep well, just as many of us are making it a habit to exercise every day or to eat right. We really should prioritize sleep.
Well, isn't one of the problems here, though, that I know Christy and I, practicing family docs, we see probably one out of five or six adults that has a sleep problem, and they can't go to sleep, and we get pressured to write prescriptions. So one of the paradoxes here, almost a catch-22, is that you're not sleeping well because you don't have a calm brain, and so you're needing to take pharmacology to help you get to that calm brain. Are you suggesting that by this cultivation of a calm brain that one would actually maybe not need to use sleeping pills?
Absolutely. I think that once you make it a habit to sleep at night, just like you make it a habit to maintain a calm brain, you're not going to need sleeping pills. There will be nights, there may be nights where you are going to have trouble sleeping, but that's, you know, common with the daily variation of life. I think the use of sleeping pills is there is a place for pills, but I think the use of sleeping pills and medications for anxiety, it's become more common than we'd like, and it probably causes more harm than good in the long run.
You know, I love what you're saying about you and your daughter having the phone off at the table and how that might promote conversation between parents and children, between parents or between spouses. And I know you touch a little bit on in your book about parenting, you know, with calmness, which seems shocking to me as a mother of two young children. And Adam's got teenagers and young adults.
And we're always calm with our teenagers.
Of course. But, you know, what tips do you have for parents?
I say with parents, give kids few choices. Don't take away as much as possible external distractions when you're together as a family. Start early so that they then become used to not having things like television at dinner time or not even having a television at all. My daughter grew up without a television at home, and she's turned out to be a pretty normal child. Try to spend, you know, do family activities together and make sure that you set an example so that I often see parents who are texting busily while their child is trying to catch their eye. So you want to do that as well. And be counterintuitive, because if a child is irritable, what you want to do is not to get irritable in response. You want to stay calm, because then that child is going to pick up some of that calm in her or his core brain.
You know, one thing, Dr. Devi, that I really love is I remember years ago I wanted to try to become, in stressful situations, less angry.
Yeah.
But that was a negative thing. I wanted to become less of something. So instead I said, well, I could develop more calmness, and if I develop more calmness, I won't be angry. And it's been a really, so your book comes at a really opportune time, I think, for the American public, where we want more of something positive rather than trying to get rid of things that are negative. And I can't say enough about that positive message that you bring to our listeners. And we really thank you for bringing such a positive message in your book.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. And I have to say that forgiveness is really one of the most important things to being calm.
And forgiving yourself.
Forgiving yourself and forgiving others. Always try to say to yourself, they are doing the best they can.
That is great advice. We could do a whole nother show, or people spend their lives trying to figure out how to forgive. It's a hard thing to do, but so important in moving forward.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest. We've been talking with Dr. Gayatri Devi about her new book, Calm Brain. Thank you again so much. And coming up on House Calls, though, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Ab and I will take a few minutes to talk about your health questions and concerns.
And you can let us know your own health questions by sending us your comments at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also go to our health application, Christy, search for Your Health, one word, for Google or Apple, and you can just quickly click on a telephone call or an email right to us with those questions.
Yeah, get the health app. Go to the iTunes store. Okay, so we have some good house calls today. Some people have reached us about polymyositis.
About a question of women living longer than men, but getting paid less.
About teenagers and fear of getting AIDS.
And then about accountable care organizations. Let's listen to our very first question about polymyositis, a hard word to say.
My mother was recently diagnosed with polymyositis. She did not have sore muscles, but did have lots of problems with her lungs and heart. Now she's on prednisone. Is this typical?
Well, we are sorry to hear about your mother having this diagnosis and struggling with the problems with her lungs and heart. And, you know, this is tough, because the severity or how badly this problem affects people is very variable. Polymyositis is an inflammatory process in the body, and for some people it can be very mild, but for other people it can give real problems with breathing and with muscles.
Yeah, it's kind of like, Christy, we had our guest on recently talking about lupus and coping and living with lupus, but we could have just said coping and living with polymyositis, because it's one of these rheumatology diseases that crosses over between pulmonary medicine, family medicine, internal medicine, rheumatology, and it affects every organ system just about. So it's not surprising that she could have these problems with lots of different areas around breathing and even her heart.
And you're asking about prednisone. Steroids, and prednisone is a type of steroid. These are used commonly in the first stages or as first medications for this illness, and it can make a difference in the strength of the muscles.
And there's other medications for long-term use that are steroid-sparing agents, but they do also have side effects. We'll have our health science librarians put up some good information here about polymyositis. It's not something maybe a lot of people have heard of, and it's not just lots of muscles that are sore, though it could be that too. And we certainly hope that she feels better and is getting better.
Let's take our next house call question.
Why do women live longer than men?
Well, I don't know. This is a silver lining to what we were talking about earlier. The women get paid less than men for the same job, but we live longer. So
I read, Christy, that over their lifetime, women will make $350,000 less than the men
of the same job
and as the physicians over their lifetime. But you're going to live 5 or 6 more years. So the question is, would you take that trade-off? I think I would rather give you the money, but let me live longer.
So the question is why, and it's a really good question. And I think the bottom line is no one really understands this, that it's complicated to do with genetic factors and then also to lifestyle choices and maybe to do with estrogen or differences in iron. There are lots of different reasons
women
speculated.
Have historically, in most recent, the 20th century, 21st century, didn't smoke as much as men, had much
less heart disease.
But I'm not sure that explains all of it.
Maybe we're just making better choices.
I don't know about that. But it could be that the brain is calmer. I know that when I go on vacation with my wife, I'm into planning and I'm firing those sympathetic nerves all the time. She's all, it's okay if we don't plan it all out. We can just go for a walk. So there's maybe a whole different mindset to a calmer brain.
Maybe. Well, let's take our next house call question. Thanks for some really interesting questions today.
Let us know what you think, why women live longer than men. I don't know if Christine have all the answers or medicine does, but we'd be curious what you think.
Okay, let's take our next one.
I heard a rumor that teenagers have less fear of getting AIDS today than a decade ago. Is this true? And if so, why is it happening?
Well, this is complicated, I think. And I'm sure a lot of it has to do with the press and medications coming out for HIV and that sort of thing.
People are less, I think, particularly teenagers, maybe less scared, and maybe adults less scared of getting it. Everyone's scared of getting it, but because it's a treatable disease now, perhaps people think it's still not contagious, which is absolutely false.
Absolutely false. And, you know, the good news is that the incidence or the new diagnoses of HIV and AIDS has declined since 1993. But the bad news is
that the rate of AIDS diagnoses for teenagers, like I have teenagers, it's nearly doubled in the last 10 years. And even rates of like sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis are going up. So the question is the fear of these diseases among teenagers less? I think it probably is.
I think it probably is too. And I think we probably as a public health system relaxed a little bit on all of the campaigns to teach teenagers about this. And I wonder if just because we're not putting as much of a push, if teenagers just think it just won't happen to them.
Well, and we know from the data from the Centers for Disease Control that less than half of girls and only a third of boys had talked with a parent about birth control and about these issues. So perhaps there's a role here for us, Christy, as parents and our listeners and parents that, you know, maybe we're needing to continue to have these conversations, not just about pregnancy prevention, but about AIDS prevention and sexually transmitted disease prevention.
Absolutely. Talk to your children. Have your children talk with their doctors with you out of the room. And make sure that they're getting the, you know, people they can talk to openly and honestly to get accurate information.
Let's talk about our very last house call question.
I have heard Dr. Page and Goldstein talk about accountable care organizations on Your Health. Can you tell me exactly what they are and how do they differ from the HMOs from 20 years ago?
Well, Chrissy, we've mentioned accountable care organizations more than once. We've actually, I think, had a show or two and a guest. But it's confusing, but people hear these terms in the newspaper talking about Obama's healthcare reform policy and insurance reform pretty much daily now.
So the Accountable Care Organization, or ACO, you hear it called, is a type of payment and delivery reform model. So it's set up.
That's obvious.
It's one of many that tries to tie the provider payments to quality metrics, prevention, reductions in the cost of care for a population of people. So when you think about it, it's tying the payment for doctors to how well they're taking care of a population of people.
Yeah, in some ways I like to describe it. The old health maintenance organization, which actually gave a kind of per patient sum to have the physicians manage those patients' problems, was designed to try to kind of push prevention, but it wasn't necessarily designed to improve quality and cut costs and really do larger populations. And these accountable care organizations are designed to try to do that. I think the jury's still out. as to whether they're going to work. But I think the entire healthcare system's moving here. I think it's a good idea. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I think, I mean, tying with the focus on quality and outcomes measures for our patients makes a lot of sense.
You know, preventing, you get, so doctors could also get paid to prevent readmissions to the hospital rather than the payment system now, which is you get a lot more money if you admit someone to the hospital.
Right. And so it makes a lot more sense to focus on prevention and to focus on getting the diabetes measures down and really doing what we need to do to reach out to our patients to take the best care that we can. So, I mean, I think it's got a lot of merit.
So regardless of what happens in the Supreme Court, Christy, I think this is moving on and marching on. And I think the insurance companies recognize that. That's why Aetna recently said they're going to actually keep a lot of the reforms under Obama's health care reform law, regardless of what the Supreme Court rules. Interesting.
Interesting. So in addition to accountable care organizations, we've talked a little bit about teenagers potentially having less fear of getting AIDS.
And our job as providers and parents to keep that conversation going about women living longer than men.
Woohoo! And finally, about polymyositis.
Well, thank you for joining us for Your Health Today. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you, and you can send any comments that you have to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And you can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes with our new health app. And we do want to thank the staff, WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Gayatri Devi. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
We'll look forward to seeing you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.